89015 Robinson v. State. Counsel for appellant, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Beaumont for the respondent, are you ready, sir?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, excellent. All right, is it Ms. Browers? Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you are.
All right, Ms. Browers, would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
All right, when the bell dings, it's on you.
Okay. I gotcha.
Excellent. Proceed when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Shanna Browers, and I have the privilege of representing the appellant Maurice Robinson in this case. Mr. Robinson is entitled to a new trial on all of his charges for the following three reasons that he did not receive a fair trial in the court below us. Firstly, he was charged with 15 counts each of elder exploitation and theft in violation of his constitutional rights against double jeopardy. The correct unit of prosecution is one unit of prosecution for elder exploitation and for theft in this case. And I'll go obviously into that. Secondly, he is entitled to a new trial because the court erred in not submitting a jury instruction, or not giving a jury instruction rather, on the scienter or knowledge requirement for the elder neglect resulting in substantial bodily harm or death. Finally, the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they had sufficient evidence in order to sustain any of these charges. I'll start, with Your Honor's permission, talking about the units of prosecution. So when we look at the...
Why is the unit of prosecution issue a constitutional double jeopardy issue as opposed to a statutory interpretation or how many counts should there be question?
It's both in this instance. So in this instance, again, Mr. Robinson was charged with 15 counts each. Essentially, they were parallel to one another. One count of elder exploitation and another count of theft for the same time period over and over again. And that's part of my argument, is that those dates or those times are arbitrary. So if we look at the statute on elder exploitation, that's NRS 200-5092. So when you look at that, it starts off with exploitation means any act taken by a person who has the trust and confidence of an older person. And obviously it goes on to say if they convert or if they exploit them financially in this instance is what the state was alleging, then they could be guilty of, in this case, a Category B felony. Additionally, for each of those counts of elder exploitation, there was a corresponding theft charge.
Counsel, can I just ask quickly?
Yes.
So under NRS 205-0834,
yes.
How do you define a course of conduct as used in that statute, the aggregating statute?
Certainly. So in terms of course of conduct, the statute is essentially written, and you're now talking about the theft statute. So as far as that one goes, that says essentially you can charge either per transaction or you can aggregate in order to reach a higher act, reach the higher standard in terms of the felony amount. In this case, the state was completely arbitrary in their selection of this. So they were alleging essentially a course of conduct, but they chose arbitrary dates in order to convert these things from what otherwise would have been misdemeanors or gross misdemeanors into the aggregate felony amount. And the time frames are completely arbitrary. It's just per month. Course of conduct is something obviously that
isn't
is ongoing.
Accurate that the victim in this case, in fact, is receiving checks each month? So wouldn't that be a theft of a different source of money each month?
I understand your question. I do think, however, that in this particular instance, because the conduct is identical, that in order that by charging them separately, because I think that's what you're asking, correct? By charging them separately,
right.
They're double dipping, for lack of a better word. Because the conduct, again, is actually the same. So in this instance, they were alleging that there was a course of conduct where Mr. Robinson was taking
these
checks.
Well, if I go to your mailbox and take the check that comes to you this month, and then I come back the next month and take the check that gets delivered the next month, isn't that two separate crimes?
So it depends on how it's on how they want to charge it. They can charge it as two separate crimes. Right. And depending on the amount of whatever that check is, if you come and take my check and it's $500, we're talking about a misdemeanor amount. So the state would have to prove, if they went that route, they would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that every single transaction or every single time it was Maurice Robinson, they would have to prove each of those beyond a reasonable doubt. And obviously for misdemeanors, we would be in justice court. In this instance, instead, they decided to go for the course of conduct route, which is fine. That's an election they can make. However, what they can't do is aggregate these numbers, aggregate the amounts, solely to reach the felony level. And why you can see that that's unfair and unjust in these circumstances is because rather than charging him with one category B felony for theft and also for exploitation, but rather than charging him with one that encompasses the entire amount, the state broke it down by month in order to have a felony amount every single time so that we're getting a category C or a category B felony as opposed to however many dozens of misdemeanors that they would have to prove. So in that, for purposes of that, they can go the route of one time a check is taken, one crime, it's a misdemeanor. But in this particular instance, they elected to go for the higher amount.
So is your argument that they can either charge each of those instances as a separate act of theft, or they can aggregate it all into one count only, not the 15? Is that your argument?
Correct.
Okay. And then why do you say that? What's your support for that?
So looking at the statute, again, when we're reviewing the statutes, the units of prosecution have never been elaborated upon by this court for either exploitation or for the theft. So in looking at the statutes, you start obviously with the plain language. So the plain language, and I'm going back to the exploitation, unless you'd rather me focus on the theft. But for the exploitation, the 200-509-2, it uses...
Counsel, can we actually keep it clean? Just on theft here.
Sure.
Theft says, calls for, if there's a scheme or continuing course of conduct, it may be aggregated in determining grade of offense. The disagreement seems to be with how the course of conduct is being defined here, or how the scheme is being defined, and in your words, essentially an arbitrary aggregation or series of aggregations by the state to inflict maximum penalty. Is that fair encapsulation of
Absolutely.
Your argument? Absolutely. How would you have us define continuing course of conduct or scheme in this case? You would say the scheme is.
And again, we submit that the state did not reach the burden to get a conviction on this, of course. But the scheme in this particular instance would be to convert these checks and to use them for his own purposes.
So the scheme is about the checks and not about the victim?
So theft is a property crime versus Correct. The exploitation is a person crime. So the theft has to do with the actual... Your Honor's looking a little askance
at
me.
Well, I mean, does that define what my scheme is? If I want to rip off my colleague here to my right, Alyssa Kadish,
again,
and I'm going to do that.
I hope
that,
you don't.
And I'm going to do that by stealing a bunch of her stuff from her purse. I mean, my scheme is to rip her off. So
sure.
Is that a proper way to
it is.
To define? Is that a broader way to define it, or what are we doing?
I think if the scheme is to rip her off, then yeah, that would be one course of conduct, and it's over the extension of time, however long that lasts. If you start taking, if you start the theft in January and then you go on and you're still doing it in December, then you stop in December, that would be one course of conduct. So the course of the scheme is to steal or, take money, property, whatever, from the victim, but it's in order to use the aggregation, they would have to use it as one scheme, or as one course of conduct or scheme, versus breaking it down. There's no, when we look at the child abuse statute, which is somewhat analogous, of course. When we look at that, we know that we get to a point where we say, okay, when it's a continuing offense, this was a continuing offense. So as the continuing offense, it stops when the conduct stops. So there's nothing, there was nothing to indicate that, that he had a new scheme every single month.
So we've addressed, I guess, already that the elder exploitation statutes recognized, right, acknowledged that they are modeled on the child abuse, yes, neglect statutes. And in that context, we have held, you know, one charge, one course of conduct. But does that then, let's assume I agree with you on the exploitation. How does that transfer to theft, which is, you just acknowledged, it's property crime.
Right.
And, you know, in a different chapter, different provisions. So how do we get there on that part of it?
Absolutely. So the way that the statute is written, of course, allows for that aggregation. So it doesn't, the legislature didn't say you have to charge per transaction or per interaction. Cool. It said universally that you can charge that way or you can aggregate. And so that's where I think that becomes relevant. Does that, if that answers your question?
It says, amounts involved in thefts committed pursuant to a scheme or continuing course of conduct, whether from one or more persons, right, may be aggregated in determining the grade of the offense.
Correct. And this court has previously said that, like, for example, let's say a grand larceny, okay? A person can be charged with one count of felony grand larceny, despite having taken things from, you know, multiple items or, you know, from multiple people. It's appropriate to charge that as one. And this court's never reversed itself on that. This court's never said, no, you got to break it down and make sure everyone's charged with every single individual act. Respectfully, I do see that my button has dinged, so you put me in charge of that.
Want to reserve the rest of your time?
Appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. Madam Clerk, give her 4 minutes, please. All right. Mr. Beaumont.
Honors. May it please the court, my name is Austin Beaumont and I'm appearing on behalf of the state. Of course, your honors are aware that this case and another case are both examining the unit's prosecution. I argued at that time in that case that I believe I said many ways elder exploitation can be committed. In the interim, I did a bit of a jurisdictional analysis for different states and how they approach elder exploitation and the units of prosecution. One case that was instructive that I'd like to point the court's attention to was Taylor versus State, a 2025 case out of Georgia, the citation being 374 Georgia Appellate 126. In that case, a person was practicing medicine without a license and on 22 separate days provided fake medical services to a singular victim, and over those 22 separate days collected 22 sets of amounts of money from that person. The appellate court upheld the conviction on all 22 of those separate counts of elder exploitation because they were finding that those were each individual and separate chargeable acts against, again, one singular victim, which is the same sort of issue that we're here with. Ordinarily, elder exploitation, again, from what I found, occurs in singular acts. So this issue doesn't come up too often.
Yeah. Does Georgia, counsel, does Georgia have a similar statutory scheme?
Nearly verbatim, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So the issues that we're looking at here as far as, well, can all of these different acts be attributed to a singular victim and sustained per multiple different counts? I think the answer is yes, because it's looking at the individual act or the transaction for an exploitation charge, not an abuse charge, because exploitations generally involve individual transactions. And when we're looking at this case specifically, on page 34 of appellant's opening brief, appellant stated that individual takings would amount to either misdemeanors or C felonies. Now that was in relation to the theft charges, but that argument really recognizes that these individual acts can be charged separately. And as to the elder exploitation counts, we didn't charge them separately. I went back and checked. Had we charged them separately, there would have been 62 category C or gross misdemeanor wobbler counts of elder exploitation and 58 B felony counts of elder exploitation. because there were something in the range of 120 different and distinct transactions on different days created by different means.
I'm sorry, can you repeat those numbers?
Yes, and my apologies if I'm one or two off, but I believe it was 58 B felony offenses for elder exploitation and 62 category C slash gross misdemeanor offenses for elder exploitation. So again, by aggregating these down, the defendant is now not exposed to 120 potential felony counts. He's exposed to only 15. And regarding the idea that we are charging these, in an arbitrary basis, arbitrary implies that we're making this by random choice or whim and not by any reason or system. But the reason or system in this case, Your Honor, earlier identified, every month around the 1st to the 3rd, there was a chunk of money. Every month, Mr. Robinson was responsible for paying for the victim's living expenses, and at every month there was no money left over.
But as I recall, the charging document, and I can only pull up one document at a time here.
Of course.
The dates varied. So one count might have a week, one count might have 2 weeks, one count might have a month. So it's not as clean as you say, but if it's the position that counts may be aggregate, that it's up to the state to determine how to aggregate, and you can aggregate however you want. It's scheme or continuous course of conduct. Do you see where there could potentially be mischief if you can just pick out which counts you want to aggregate when we have like a year worth of transactions? So let's make it a week. A guy's going through a neighborhood, he's stealing mail all week from all the neighbors, and he's got this pocket of money. So is there a week? And you add them all together, and maybe that's a cat B 1 to 20, maybe that's a cat B 1 to 10. Or you could turn that into 7 cat Bs by, I'm going to take this check on this day, I'm going to take this check on Wednesday. Do you see my concern? I'm trying to figure out what guardrails or what rule does it mean? What are we saying that means?
Absolutely. So that specific instance, a fellow going around and stealing mail, as it applies to elder exploitation, there's two different things.
I'm thinking of theft. I'm talking about theft aggregation right now. I'm sorry.
Of course. And the aggregation issue implies another issue that we don't really get into in the pleadings here because it wasn't really part of the analysis, but that's allocation. So when we have, for example, in a month, let's say there are 10 different acts that total $100,000, just throwing out numbers here. But during that time period, let's say that the caretaker paid for $50,000 worth of the victim's expenses. How do we allocate those costs that were paid toward the victim and benefited the victim against 10 different counts that go up to $100,000? The allocation of those reasonable and really necessary funds that go to the benefit of the victim make it effectively impossible for us to charge 10 different charges, because how do you back that out from each individual charge? The answer is really we can't. So that built-in guardrail in that situation, we would charge likely one large account or one count for that amount of time, and then whatever's left over from the amount that was used for that victim would be what's charged. Because to do otherwise would make math horribly confusing for the jury, horribly confusing for us to present.
So
it would work in their benefit.
The fact that you're relying on, if I'm understanding what you're explaining right now, it has to do with the fact that each month funds were coming in, but by the end of the month there was virtually none left. So you're not having to trace through exactly what's coming in and what's going out. Is that kind of the gist of what you're saying?
Exactly. So if there was any individual month in which, for example, in this case, I believe the round number was $7,000, the numbers provided by the defendant was that there were $1,500 worth of living expenses that he was to pay for the victim, and we gave another $1,000 buffer for food for Mr. Turner at the time, saying that that's $2,500 that should be spent on his care and maintenance. If there was any individual month where, forced to do math now, $4,500 was left over in the account at the end of the month, we wouldn't have charged that month because there was nothing exploited beyond what his necessary expenses were. So that's our built-in guardrail against mischief, as Your Honor put it, to make sure that this is not an overcharging situation. But similarly, if we're in a situation where someone was perhaps a paid caretaker and they had absolutely no reason whatsoever to have that person's money, and there were 10 separate transactions of $10,000 apiece, those could conceivably be charged individually as well. I can't say that what we would do in an individual situation is what we would do right now, but it's really up to just the individual facts of the case, because there are so many different ways that exploitation can be committed. So we have to have some leeway and some charging discretion.
In this case, you agree, though, one avenue could have been to charge one aggregated theft greater than $100,000 and one aggravated exploitation greater than $5,000.
I believe in this case the aggregate would have been capped at $25,000 because I believe these were committed in 2018.
Gotcha.
The aggregate of the elder exploitation would have been capped at $5,000 as well, I believe. But yes, we may, under the statute, aggregate if there is a continuing course of conduct. But again, under the facts of this case, it seemed more natural and appropriate that each given month there was a pile of money, each given month there was an amount of money that was supposed to be spent, and no extra money was to be spent on or by Mr. Robinson. So each individual month seemed appropriate as an aggregation standpoint. Additionally, the appellant's reading of these statutes effectively changes may aggregate into must aggregate. So it ignores the notion of exploitations like Mr. Robinson's and again in Ms. Smith's, where it is either a six-year exploitation of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, or a year and a half long exploitation of tens of thousands, of over hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's something that's a case-by-case basis that we try to do the most justice possible given the facts of each individual case. As far as, sorry, I've been lost. Oh, yes. The theft statute, these are intertwined as far as the units of prosecution. Again, it's may aggregate, it's not must aggregate. The theft statute, or the theft charges, were designed to mirror the amounts and times. And to the best of my recollection, Your Honor, the amended information started at the beginning of the month when each amount was deposited and ended at the end of the month when the money was gone. And I think that was any sort of discretion the numbers might not have matched up for that, but they were charged by month.
Can I just change gears for a moment?
Of course.
Talk about the jury instruction number 24 about the neglect and the knowledge requirement, which we recognized in our Valerie v. State 2002, where we held there was sort of new or reason to know that it would cause harm. And not only did the instruction here not include that in the charge to the jury, but it also says that there's no requirement of ill will or recklessness, which that is probably correct, but it doesn't say, but there does have to be knowledge or reason to know. What do you do with that?
So on appeal,
more to the point, what should we do with that?
Of course, thank you. So looking at the lights most favorable to the prosecution as far as this issue goes, a reasonable jury, and this jury did find that Mr. Robinson had every reason to know of what Mr. Turner was supposed to have taken care of him. He was explained to on multiple occasions by in-home RNs, in-home nurses, that these are the things that Mr. Turner needs. These are the things that you must do to keep him healthy. These are the things you must do to keep him well. And after all these different times that he'd been told by doctors, in-home nurses, et cetera, and just visually seeing Mr. Turner on a day-to-day basis, it's a rational person's analysis, really, of what had happened in this case, saying that, look, you have to move him. You have to make sure he's moving around. You have to feed him. You have to make sure that he's clean. You have to make sure that he's bathed. You have to make sure that you don't take off for a week, and when you find him on the floor of the home, move him into a bathroom, sit him on a plastic chair, and leave him for a couple more days to rot. This is what the jury unfortunately heard. The facts of this case are egregious, and it's neglect. We're not saying that Mr. Robinson had some sort of ill will or hatred or anything like that towards Mr. Turner. He had just voluntarily assumed a duty for his care and then failed to follow through with that duty of care. He neglected him for a long enough period of time that Mr. Turner effectively rotted away.
So if I hear you, are you acknowledging the instruction should have had that element, but
of that
knowledge that he knew or had reason to know?
Knew or had reason to know that it was...
That it would cause harm, too.
No, and I don't believe that the staff...
You don't think that the instruction was an error, even?
I don't believe it was an error as written. My recollection is that that particular instruction came from the model instruction booklet.
Okay.
That is my recollection. But as far as the arguments that were made to the jury within their... before they deliberated, we made very clear that we were not charging with Mr. Robinson with any sort of, again, reckless behavior. We were just...
No, I understand, but are you familiar with the Valerie case where we held that it had to be knew or should have known that the actions would harm the victim? Is that a requirement for this crime?
I believe... My apologies. My recollection was that as the instruction was written, it was not an error to give it based upon the instructions, based upon the recitation of the statutory language. That is my recitation, and that as Valerie goes, it does comport with Valerie in the way that it was written and given to the jury. And again, as far as sufficient evidence for the jury to have found this, if the statute or if the instruction was given an error, there was substantial and overwhelming evidence that Mr. Turner or that Mr. Robinson was put on notice from a number of different sources as to what the care and maintenance of Mr. Turner should have been. This was...
So if error, it was harmless?
Yes. If error, it was harmless just based upon the overwhelming amount of information given to Mr. Robinson and that Mr. Robinson himself made other witnesses aware of his knowledge of. He knew exactly what he was supposed to do. He told other people what he was supposed to do, and he voluntarily took on that role and just failed to do so. Thank you, Your Honors.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Of course.
Was the purpose of aggregating these thefts into 15 different charges of felonies, was the purpose of that to be able to enhance the sentencing?
No.
Okay.
No. Again, if we try to avoid any sort of notion of overcharging here. As I'd said earlier, I believe we counted 58 B felonies and 62 C felonies. Had we not aggregated these, we would have also run into issues with apportionment, so we wanted to make sure that it was as fair as possible under the circumstances of this particular case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
May it please the court. I first want to address the additional authority that my colleague cited, the Taylor versus State. I had the opportunity to quickly look that up. And what that actually stands for the elder exploitation statute in Georgia, it uses the word any, which is obviously the operative word that we are kind of focused on for these. But in Georgia, they're talking about any person who commits an act. Our statute says any act that is done against an elderly person. So that's distinct, firstly, on those grounds, because it's talking about the any talks about a perpetrator versus any as opposed to an act. So obviously this court has found before that any is an ambiguous term.
But wouldn't any act support more different charges rather than fewer charges?
Well, not according to this court's jurisprudence. So in other statutes that this court has analyzed, when it comes to any, and as it's used in our statutes, any is an ambiguous term. It could mean one, it could be several, it could be anything, really. And because it's ambiguous, that's why we turn to the interpretation canon, which is essentially, obviously, you start with its plain language. Neither of the statutes that I'm here to talk about today plainly make it clear if it's one or more. Secondarily, you look at the legislative history or any kind of judicial commentary that's been made on similar statutes in the past, and as far as that goes, I think the child abuse statute is the one that's the most analogous in this instance, where, again, we're talking about a continuous course of conduct. The state still has not, and I don't believe would ever be able to really explain correctly or appropriately why a course of conduct started in 1 month and then stopped and then started again the next day and then stopped. That's what's arbitrary about it. They're aggregating these amounts to reach the felony level for a higher punishment. It's certainly not any kind of safeguard against Mr. Robinson. As to his point that, well, okay, we could have charged 62, I think is the number that he chose. Okay, well, they could have charged 62 then if they wanted to. They didn't. They decided to bring these all together in order to reach a higher number, but then they broke it down in order to reach a higher number of charges. So they wanted the high amount in order to reach a higher felony charge, and then they cut away at that big number in a completely arbitrary manner in order to reach the number of felonies that they did charge.
So if let's assume for a moment we agree with your arguments as to the unit of prosecution on the elder exploitation and the theft, which assume for a moment, right?
Yes.
So there would be still at least one count of the exploitation, which would be a large maximum B felony, right? And the theft, which would be the maximum amount available under theft. There would still be one conviction for exploitation, one conviction for theft, the one for negligence, so assume for the moment. And I guess my question is, would any of that warrant a new trial?
Absolutely it would.
Why?
So, yes, I you've hit the nail on the head. That is exactly what I'm saying, is it's one and one. And it does necessitate a new trial, because it's relevant in the sense that he knows, Mr. Robinson has to know what it is that he's fighting against, essentially. But when you're looking again at what the statute says, and I'll finish if you don't mind. If you look at what the statutes say, you have to be guided by that. So obviously we know that statutes need to be strictly construed against the state. Statutes need to be given their plain meaning. In absence of clarity on that, you go to those other sources. Those other sources overwhelmingly show that there should only have been one charge for exploitation, one charge for theft, and then I believe my time is essentially up, but if you wanted me to talk about the jury instruction, I'm more than happy to.
I think we're good, counsel.
I think we're good.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate you.